Around with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! The hour, this the 21st day of February 2014, Friday on the front porch on the horn, or for those of you so inclined, it is now also known as Friday in the fetal position on the front porch on the horn. At any rate, this is our by now traditional close of the week. Great big massive round table evening. I look forward to these things because we get some really good conversation going. So how do you participate in Friday on the front porch in the fetal position? Well, there are four phone lines that you can use, and there is of course the venerable Horn Molloy Skype chat group. And if you'd like to participate that way, well, you would need to sign into your Skype account and send a contact request to Sparky Dunk, SparkyDunk, Sparky Dunk. And that will get you entree to the Horn Molloy Skype chat group. It's my understanding that the Horn Molloy Skype chat group Friday night, Chattapalooza, will continue this evening immediately after the closing of the program, being as how Molloy is off this evening. So jump right in. You're welcome to. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is, of course, our home. That's where you'll find the brand new shiny Listen Live button, and that's where you'll find a selection of news stories that piqued my interest and the interest of others over the course of the day that are added to the main page, gosh, almost daily. You'll also find the HeadOnRadioNetwork.com chat room, which is free for your enjoyment, and folks are wandering by even now, even as we speak. Texas Betsy and Sparky and Lottie and Chug-a-Punch and Jan are all in there. More will be arriving shortly, I've no doubt. We've had some rousing good crowds in the Horn Molloy, the Horn chat room. I'm confusing it with the Horn Molloy Skype chat group. I'm getting ahead of myself. We've had some rousing good crowds in there of late. In fact, Waggy just popped in. Good evening, Waggy. And also at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, you will find the PayPal button and the traditional mail address, which you can use to help us keep all of this going. If you prefer to use the traditional mails over PayPal, you can send your contributions, your kind gifts to The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, B-E-C-K-L-E-Y, Beckley, W-V, 25801. And a gentle reminder, please don't make anything payable to Bob Kincaid, as Bob Kincaid is not the recipient of these things. This is what keeps us on the air. And if you do prefer to go the traditional mail route, just send me a note so that I can acknowledge it. We really do appreciate your support no matter how you provide it. And this evening, thanks to a contribution that rolled in early in the wee hours of this morning, it was about a quarter to two this time. Alex helping out and finished off the fundraising for last night and got us started on this evening. So instead of the usual $150 we try to raise on any given evening, it's only $130 tonight. So let's cross our fingers and hope that we finish the week to the good, or even, as it were. Now, Friday on the front porch, this program changed rather dramatically as of January the 9th, 2014. That was the night we first found out that the long labors of earnest efforts at deregulation and favoritism pointed toward poisoners and industrialists over the needs and well-being of the people of this minor key state, West Virginia, had finally borne fruit. That was the day of the Freedom Industries, coal industry-derived water disaster that has been going on ever since. So when I say that the program has changed since January the 9th, it has changed insofar as I can never get very far away from recognizing the realities of what has happened to this state, which I do love so very much. It is a dysfunctional relationship, to say the least. But we have news, and while on the one hand, Gert, you know, we just call him Gert now because it's such a mouthful to say, Governor Earl Ray Tomlin, Gert wants to be done with all of this water disaster that was caused by his political campaign contributors. Gert very badly wants to be done with all of this. And, in fact, he wants to be done with it so badly that he's trying to put stuff out there that'll just make people feel better enough that maybe they'll agree with me that, hey, it's all over with. It was 2 days ago in the right-wing newspaper in Charleston, West Virginia, the Daily Mail, that they published a story entitled, Tomlin ready to focus on recovery. Oh, really? Yeah, from the story, after more than 40 days in a state of emergency following a massive chemical spill last month, Governor Earl Ray Tomlin, Gert, said he believes West Virginia, notice he's believing, he's not knowing, big difference. Of course, if you remember the Horn family commune, you know that. He believes West Virginia is almost ready to officially focus on recovery. We're looking at the end of the state of emergency, Tomlin said Tuesday following a press event at the state capitol. Yeah, but no. No, we're not quite ready for recovery. Of course, we won't know if... That's the funny thing about poisoning the water supply of 300,000 human beings. The problem with industrial toxins and poisons is that you really don't know if you're out of the woods for about 20 years. So it would seem to be about 19 years and 10 months early to be declaring the end of the emergency. And oopsie, he may have been just a tad preemie in that determination. A story published today at the Charleston Gazette by, of course, Ken Ward Jr. And what in God's name do we have to do to get this man a Pulitzer? Ken notes that the Charleston Gazette, who is doing an admirable job of fulfilling its role in serving the public and, you know, living up to that whole fourth estate thingy, It turns out there was something about all the information, or lack thereof, flowing out of the Gert administration. There was something there that I guess just made some ears perk up and wonder, So, lo and behold, the Charleston Gazette filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the Gert administration, and the Department of Military Affairs and Public Safety. Now, remember, the Department of Military Affairs and Public Safety and its Homeland Security Department is run by a guy named Jimmy Giannotto, who, of the 108,000-gallon toxic waste spill into the Kanawha River, well, Fields Creek and then the Kanawha River, said, well, I don't think it added up much nothing. Well, because of this Freedom of Information Act request, they kind of had to respond to it, or else, you know, get sued. And what the Gazette wanted to know in particular, which Ken Ward is writing about here, is, you know, gee, I wonder, does the Gert administration have any water sampling results that maybe they haven't told us about? I mean, would the Gert administration sit on information and not disclose it? Would they? And if so, why? We have our answer. The Tomlin administration, writes Ken Ward Jr., today released previously undisclosed test results showing low levels of the chemical MCHM in the regional water supply. Now, personally, I see that phrase, low levels of the chemical MCHM, as, and, you know, this is because I'm a squishy, liberal, progressive, try-to-be-science-y kind of person. I see the phrase low levels of MCHM in the regional water supply. I see that to mean there's still MCHM in the regional water supply. Because, see, and I don't want to put too fine a point on this, there shouldn't be any MCHM in the regional water supply. There is not, MCHM is not a naturally occurring chemical. It only occurs where you've got a coal, an outlaw rampant coal industry that has to have the MCHM with which to treat and prep its coal in order to send it to China or some coal-fired power plant or God knows where. So, yes. The State Department of Military Affairs and Public Safety, oddly enough, not the Department of Health and Human Resources, go figure, disclosed the results and posted them online, and dozens, that would be multiples of 12, as in at least 24, samples showed levels of MCHM that were below the 10 parts per billion detect limit that the state has used. But looky, above the 2 part per billion detection limit that another lab contracted by the state has been using. Now, Thomas Kirk is general counsel for the Department of Military Affairs and Public Safety, which is different from the department that's charged with giving a good goddamn about human beings, according to Ken Ward, emphasized in an email message to the Gazette that the results must be viewed within the context of the 1 part per million health screening level set by the U.S., yada, yada, yada. Because I'm sure, you know, that caveat from Tom Kirk, well, it had to be there because you know how it is with those journalisty people. I mean, sometimes they can't understand things, and they need themselves some context provided. Yeah. So to recap, there is still methyl chlorohexane methanol in the water, of the people of the Kanawha Valley and the eight surrounding eight counties around and nearby Kanawha County. It's still the poison's still in the water. And this would have taken how long for the Gert administration to tell anybody? Right. Jim noting by email, boy, that's what I call famous last words. Oops, I just gargled with Drano. Hoo-wee! So really, we are at, 11 minus a month and 12 days, coming up on 6 weeks since this disaster began unfolding. A month and 12 days since Earl Ray Tomlin sat around wondering what he should do because he didn't have authorization yet from his masters over to the coal and chemical and oil and gas industries, and let 300,000 people consume poison for somewhere between 6 or 8 or more hours, at least 6, at most 8 hours maybe, once they found out this stuff was in the water supply. And almost 6 weeks later, it's still in the water supply, and almost 6 weeks later, we still don't know what it does to human beings. Well, yeah, we kind of do. I mean, people showing up with rashes and burning sensations, people who are in various forms of different ability, who have this have had this poison water injected into their feeding tubes. Yeah, we don't know. We don't know. I was reading a post from a friend of mine over on Facebook today, and she was talking about overhearing a couple of what we would refer to as little old ladies out to the Target store. And she reported on Facebook that the little old ladies were wondering when all the spring fun in the sun swimwear, swim gear stuff was going to come in. And, you know, I read it and I thought, that's optimistic. That's nice. We had a lovely day here today. Got up into the 60s and clear blue skies that followed a real hellbender of a thunderstorm last night. But you see days like this, the snow's all gone now. And you begin to sense that maybe spring is around the corner. That maybe we can put away the parkas and the gloves and the winter boots and turn to thinking about things like, tomatoes, late July, yum. But then it turned out that in the story my friend was relating on Facebook, it turned out that the little old ladies were wondering when the swim gear was going to show up, because they were looking to get some of those little plastic goggles that swimmers wear, because they thought that they would be handy in keeping their eyes from being burned every time they take a shower. Mind you, their eyes were not getting burned every time they took a shower before January the 9th. And as my friend noted, this is a damn sorry state of affairs that's what people in the golden years of their life are worrying about in America's sacrifice zone. So there's your toxic West Virginia update. Meanwhile, over at the offices of the good old boys of Freedom Industries, well, they sent their lawyers along to a bankruptcy hearing today. Mm-hmm. Mark Friedlander is a lawyer who is mouthpiecing for Freedom Industries. Good money in poison. And he addressed the U.S. bankruptcy court today, this morning, and told them that, well, Freedom's wrapping up business, selling off all of its inventory, getting rid of its workers. It'll be a matter of days, Friedlander said, after all of Freedom's remaining chemical inventory will have been sold. And they have surprisingly reached the conclusion that it is no longer viable or practical to continue operating Freedom Industries. What a fraud. Remember, the guy who, J. Clifford Forrest, the guy who purchased Freedom Industries shortly before the disaster, after the disaster, then provided $5 million of continued operating capital under a shell company that had been formed the day of the filing of the bankruptcy petition. So Freedom Industries will dissolve, disappear, and all the people that it poisoned will go and pound sand. Can we please take a moment to remember that the bankruptcy code, where corporations are concerned, represents a form of welfare. This is corporate welfare. Nothing, and I do mean nothing, will happen to J. Clifford Forrest, or to Denny Who's His Face, or to Gary Southern. They're going to go on being very, very, very wealthy men. By the way, they're selling off their inventory of chemicals to their competitors. Where's it going? Now, we know, for instance, that J. Clifford Forrest owns Rosebud Mining of Kittanning, Pennsylvania. Guess what? Way back, on February 5th, the Charleston Gazette reported, Ken Ward did, that they were loading that stuff and shipping it to Pennsylvania. Hello, Horn family members, Western Pennsylvania. Might want to be paying attention. By the way, at the bankruptcy hearing, none of the poisoners from Freedom Industries thought it really necessary to show up. But Gary Southern, the guy who sipped from his bottle of water on the night the poisoning went down, he did issue a statement via a press release. And said that selling off the inventory represents Freedom's best opportunity to generate funds it needs for our environmental remediation efforts. And then he sadly noted that some job losses at Freedom would be inevitable. See there? A few thousand gallons of poison go in the public water drinking supply, and we're killing jobs. I mean, there they were, Freedom Industries, good, upstanding, God-fearing, American, patriotic, freedom-loving job creators, and just because they dumped a little bit of unknown 10,000 gallons of poison in the public water drinking supply, now people are going to lose their damn jobs. Lawsuits against Freedom Industries have sprung up like mushrooms after a spring rain. They get to all go themselves. Because guess who's first in line for any money that's left over after the bankruptcy? Guess who gets the money? J. Clifford Forrest, who put the money up in the first place, gets the money. Yeah. just like he's already gotten some of the crude methylchlorohexane methanol, and it's probably sitting in a tank somewhere in the pit, in the greater Pittsburgh area, and people don't know, aren't going to know it until their water smells like licorice, until their skin begins to burn, until they bathe their babies in it. Sometimes it goes upstream. How about that? And U.S. bankruptcy judge Ronald J. Pearson said, based on what we've heard announced today, there's a serious limit on funding available. Unless you are J. Clifford Forrest. Right? Estimates from the filing show that that Freedom will pay out some $700,000 in legal and financial advising fees over the next 3 weeks. Which is okay under the bankruptcy code. So maybe there was some job creating after all. So there you have it. Yeah, WV Funding LLC is the outfit that provided the $5 million, by the way. And yes, J. Clifford Forrest is WV Funding LLC. It's going to pay $3 million back to J. Clifford Forrest with interest. It'll also pay a $20,000 lender fee. This is some racket. They'll be back in bankruptcy court come Tuesday. Just in case you might be interested in knowing what it was like to be on the inside of Freedom Industries, their bankruptcy filing shows that they had $16 million in assets and $6 million in liabilities when they filed for bankruptcy. Little or none of that $16 million will go to any of the people who were poisoned. Let's see. Between July 1, 2011 and June 30th, 2012, they made $25.6 million, Freedom Industries did. $25.6 million. That's a lot of crude methylchlorohexane methanol. How much do you reckon that stuff goes for a quart? Because the standard that I read somewhere along the way was that it takes about a quart of this stuff to 1,000 gallons of water in the coal prep process. They made $25.6 million selling chemicals. They made $30.6 million between July 1st and 2012 and June 30, 2013. And they were on track for a banner year between July 1, 2013 and January 9th, 2014. They had already raked in $19.6 million. Here's one of the more humorous aspects of the filing. The tank farm, where the tank failed and poisoned 300,000 people's water. Freedom valued the tank farm at $8,000. Well, hell, no wonder it failed. It'd be worth $8,000 in salvage if it was nothing but rust, wouldn't it? Yeah. As of December 31st, there were $5.3 million worth of inventory. They've got more than $1 million worth of machinery. They've got more than $5 million in inventory. Yeah. But we haven't gotten to the fun part yet. What was it worth to be one of the exalted mucky mucks of Freedom Industries? Well, let's see. They have paid Gary Southern, Dave McComble, Cliff Forrest, Dennis Farrell. Yeah. And all of those have been paid something north of $150,000 apiece. Good work if you can get it, poisoning the water supply of 300,000 people. Really? No, Jim, I'm not kidding. It's Rosebud Mining of Katanning, Pennsylvania. Yes, redolent of Charles Foster Kane. Not a joke. Steve with a note says, please explain this to me. A company can enter bankruptcy and have obligations to people that it poisons, discharged. However, it can't go into bankruptcy to get these MFing banks off my... I can't go into bankruptcy to get these MFing banks off my back and have that discharged. Correct. That was all part of the... What was it? The patriotic bankruptcy freedom restoration renewal act of, what, 2005? Something like that. Yes. Steve, if you were a corporation, you could be very happily situated. So, there you have it. That's our little update for, the ongoing disaster here in West Virginia. Lovely, ain't it? What else? Oh, there's lots of else. Joe Manchin has chimed in. I was wandering over past Charlie Pierce's place at Esquire.com, his politics blog, and ran across a quote from Joe Manchin. This is the first time we have issued the duct tape and tennis ball warning for this evening in a... In a story out of ripped from the page from the headlines, right? He was questioned. Joe was briefly about this ongoing disaster, and you know Joe's very soft-spoken, and he, for some reason or another, he's got a bit of a cult following among people who think that somehow or another he's a middle-of-the-roader, and, you know, he can reach across the aisle to the people who are crazier than a sprayed roach over in the Republican Party. And when the conversation did turn to the ongoing disaster, he said, people don't think we care at all about the environment, that we value jobs and business over the environment. But that's the exception, not the rule. Huh? Who's the exception? What is the rule? Because that's all he's ever said. Jobs! I'm a friend of coal. Why aren't you a friend of coal? Now, there's that very famous clip of him speaking down at the Greenbrier a few years back. My name's Joe Manchin, and I'm a friend of coal. And then addressing his previously extremely hostile and stupid, I might add, stance antagonistic toward the Environmental Protection Agency, he said, we blame them, but then we need them. I'm an environmentalist. I care about the environment, but I'm a realist, too. I care about my job. Sweet Jeebus. Joe Manchin's an environmentalist. Well, I'm glad I abandoned being called an environmentalist a long time ago, because when you allow yourself to be labeled an environmentalist, it means that you're letting the other side label you as someone who is more by their definition, cares more about aesthetics and birds and bugs and beetles and butterflies and bullfrogs than you do about the continued ability of human beings to go on being human beings. So that's when I started referring to myself as a human rights activist. And I know we could probably have a discussion about all of that, but I'm not going to wear the clothes that this corporate coal culture hands to me to wear. They're not giving me a check. I remember a few years ago when we were up on a mountain trying to do what we could to save it. And all these coal workers and their screeching, screaming wives surrounded us. And they were all wearing the same T-shirts. They were wearing the clothes the company had given them and made them wear. And that just struck me as kind of gross. Sad. What? Codependent. But if Joe Manchin is an environmentalist, I want nothing to do with ever being called one again. Of course, the right wing coal industry has been. I've heard Bill Rainey. That weaselly little bastard who's in charge over there at the Friends of Coal, West Virginia Coal Association. Coal people are the most vaguest environmentalists in West Virginia. You can actually see him say that in a scene inside the film The Last Mountain. Hint, they're not at all. Oh, God. Hi, I'm Joe Manchin, environmentalist. You know, if he said that in front of people, like at a gathering or a political whatnot here in West Virginia, everybody would laugh. Everybody would understand that it was a sly inside joke. Yeah. So that's where we are. That's what it means, at least this evening, to live in the Appalachian Sacrifice Zone. It's by no means all that we have to talk about this evening. Lots and lots more. And that's the way it often is on Friday on the front porch. You may recall last night we were talking about the abuse of cattle in Idaho Stan. Well, guess what? Idaho will take a back seat to no one when it comes to anti-government wing nuttery. You may recall last night's story was about the ag gag bill making its way through the Idaho Stan legislature as a result of one of the job creators being caught jumping up and down, stomping on cattle, fondling their genitals, dragging them alive, around with straps on their necks and dragging them behind tractors and things like that. Well, they can walk and chew gum at the Idaho Stan legislature. They've got themselves a new bill. Representing Paul Shepard, a Republican from Riggins, Idaho Stan, has decided to have a run at that old nullification. Idaho Stan House Bill 473 reads as follows. Section 39-102B. By the way, House Bill number 473 relating to regulations of the Environmental Protection Agency. Amending Chapter 1, Title 39, Idaho Code, yada, 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 and declaring an emergency. Really? An emergency? You mean like when an unregulated industry dumps 10,000 gallons of poison in 300,000 people's drinking? Like that emergency? Section 39-102B. Environmental Protection Agency regulations. Null and void. The legislature declares that the regulation authority of the United States Environmental Protection Agency, which does not in this draft even merit capital letters, Environmental Protection Agency doesn't, is not authorized by the Constitution of the United States and violates its true meaning and intent as given by the founders and ratifiers, and is hereby declared to be invalid in the state of Idaho, shall not be recognized by this state, is specifically rejected by this state, and shall be considered null and void, and of no force and effect in this state. 2. It shall be the duty of the legislature of the state of Idaho to adopt and enact any and all measures as may be necessary to prevent the enforcement of regulations issued by the United States Environmental Protection Agency that are not specifically authorized by the Congress of the United States or specifically adopted by the legislature of the state of Idaho, Section 2. An emergency existing therefore, which emergency is hereby declared to exist. Wow, that's some top-notch logic. This act shall be in full force and effect on and after its passage and approval. Wowzer. Nullification. Goodness me. Now, I'm a peaceable soul, but I really do think it's time to do something about these nullificationists. I mean, sure, We live, to a certain extent, expecting a little soupçon of nullification to come out of South Carolina. I mean, after all, they're the treason state. And granted, you got all kinds of freedom-protecting, gun-loving, bear-arming people in, you know, Idaho Stan. Wolverines! Who will gladly stand up against that Kenyan Muslim anti-colonialist with a deep-seated hatred of white people. But sooner or later, these jerks have got to be taught a lesson. I mean, National Guard, maybe? So, the bill has had its second reading. And it may well pass the Idaho House. Who knows? Now, what's the necessity for this bill? Well, goodness me. It turns out that there may be some old gold-bearing tailings in the streams of Idaho. It was back on February the 4th when the newspaper up Idaho way published a story, Gold Miners Ask State to Stop New EPA Permit. Suction gold dredgers pleaded, on bended knee, little tears falling out of their eyes, emaciated wraiths that they are. Suction gold dredgers pleaded with state lawmakers to stand up to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and make it back off enforcement of a new-to-Idaho permit that protects many gold-bearing streams. Referring to the EPA and its officials as jackbooted thugs in SWAT uniforms, Tom Kitcher, president of the Waldo Mining District in Oregon, spoke to a joint meeting of the Senate Resources and Environment and House Resources and Conservation Committees. The new permit is required since May, and it is it comes as a result of the actual enforcement of a little federal law called the Clean Water Act. Twin Falls gold dredger Jim Kepner said, "I'm not happy with it at all, and I don't think it's necessary." Yeah. He applied to dredge in four areas of the Payette River, and they turned him down for three. He was allowed a suction dredging permit for the Snake River near American Falls, Idaho. But that's not good enough for Jim Kepner. Oh, there's gold there, but it's not one of those areas, but it's one of those areas where it ain't real great. Because, see, suction gold dredging is not without pollution. And I know the weird denizens of the state of Idaho might find it a little bit surprising, but those are, even though it's in Idaho, those rivers are deemed to be rivers of the United States, just like waters of the United States, just like the Elk River that Freedom Industries dumped 10,000 gallons of poison into. Just like the Kanawha River that Patriot Coal dumped 108,000 gallons of poison into. And just because you're a money-grubbing little freak does not mean that you are necessarily entitled under the Constitution and laws of the state of the United States to go and shit up any stream that you want to just because you think you might make a few bucks. 162 applicants sought to dredge in 370 sites around Idaho. EPA permitted 81 locations. Hence, because one may presume that the state of Idaho favors the pollution of its rivers, and of course the it seems kind of silly to talk about liquidating a river, but yeah, liquidating it for gold. They have just declared their right, well, assuming they pass this bill, they will have, their right to nullify any federal law that they decided they don't like. But this bill is not just with regard to mucking around for gold. This bill nullifies everything the EPA does in Idaho, even though the Clean Water Act was passed by both houses of Congress and signed into law by the President of the United States. So, the disease, the nullification disease, is spreading. You reckon maybe Idaho might like to nullify, how about the Civil Rights Act or the Voting Rights Act, or how about the Clean Water Act? Maybe they'd just like to go back to the Articles of Confederation and say the hell with it. And, by the way, since we were talking about Idaho and we were talking about beef and meat and it's what's for dinner and all of that, you might also note that if you've got any hot pockets, in your freezer, you might double check them, because a little warning has come out. And you want to talk about creepy language for me to be using to ruin somebody's dinner right now? Hi, Scott. Hi, Linda. Nestle, who thinks that you should buy all of your water from them, Nestle has recalled some of their Hot Pockets. Philly steak and cheese Hot Pockets in three different pack sizes, Hot Pockets brand croissant crust Philly steak and cheese in the two-pack box. Basically, your Philly steak and cheeses are being recalled. I mean, it's not like the bread's stale or maybe the veggies were a little dodgy, the onions weren't quite sweet enough. No, they are these Hot Pockets may very well have been stuffed with what is being referred to as, and this is a quote, this is not inflammatory language that I use just to ruin your dinner. These Philly cheese steak, Philly steak and cheese croissant crust and Philly steak and cheese regular Hot Pockets have apparently, possibly, maybe been stuffed with what are referred to as diseased and unsound animals. Yeah. This follows from a massive USDA recall of 8.7 million pounds of meat that was processed by Rancho Feeding Corp. Of, I believe, California. Okay, yeah. Unsound, unwholesome, or otherwise unfit for human food and must be removed from commerce. Oh, no, I'm sorry. The Hot Pockets were produced at the Nestle California facility. Hey, Grandpa, what's for supper? Diseased and unsound animals. Makes it sound like there might be some skunk in it. Or maybe some mad cow. Or maybe some anthrax cattle or hoof and mouth cattle. Who knows? Because these are the job creators. And because regulation is a job killer. The USDA headline, however, is a little bit telling. California firm recalls unwholesome meat products, and this is the takeaway, produced without the benefit of full inspection. Rancho Feeding Corporation, a Petaluma, California establishment, is recalling approximately 8,742,700 pounds because it processed diseased and unsound animals and carried out these activities without the benefit or full benefit of federal inspection. Does that mean if they had processed diseased and unsound animals, but federal inspectors had been there, they would be okay? Thus, the products are adulterated because they are unsound, unwholesome, or otherwise are unfit for human food and must be removed from commerce. Meanwhile, the Obama administration, USDA, is moving forward on its plan to let chicken producers self-inspect. Even though, as noted weeks, months ago, the pilot projects in places like Canada and New Zealand, where this was tried out, routinely had elevated levels of unsafe food, but, you know, job creating, right? The following Rancho Feeding Corporation products are subject to recall. Beef carcasses, 2 per box beef market heads, 4 gallons per box beef blood, 20-pound boxes of beef oxtail, 30-pound boxes of beef cheeks, 30-pound boxes of beef lips, 30-pound boxes of beef omasum, O-M-A-S-U-M, 30-pound boxes beef tripe, 30-pound boxes of mountain oysters, 30-pound boxes of sweetbreads, 30 and 60-pound boxes of beef liver, 30 and 60-pound boxes of beef tripe. Okay, so maybe that maybe beef tripe is something different. 30 and 60-pound boxes of beef tongue, 30 and 60-pound boxes of veal cuts, 40-pound boxes of veal bones, 50-pound boxes of beef feet, 50-pound boxes of beef hearts, and 60-pound boxes of veal trim. To see when you're Nestle and you're making your Hot Pockets, that's how you buy your beef. Yeah. Each box bears the case code number ending in 3 or 4. The products were produced in January 1, 2013 through January 7, 2014 and shipped to distribution centers and retail establishments nationwide. So may we assume that Nestle uses some of those beef feet, beef lips, you know, in the Hot Pockets? I don't know. Jesus. So that's a pretty rip roaring Jim Dandy start, I think, to this Friday on the Front Porch conversation, to which you are all warmly invited, should you wish to participate if you're listening in real time. If not, you know, anytime you've got something to add to the conversation and you maybe listen on the podcast, or it's, you can always shoot an email, bobkincaid@gmail.com, bobkincaid@gmail.com. So just do as you see fit, and we'll get Friday on the Front Porch started post haste. We are trying to raise $130 this evening to finish the week even with our fundraising goals. Mail or PayPal button is just fine, however, again, as you see fit. This is listener-supported conversation radio. This is the horn. And we'll be firing up Friday on the Front Porch right quickly-like. Moo, y'all. Moo.
Crying disgrace.
Oh, if that's not a grooving tune for a Friday night, I don't know what it is. It's so outrageous. Steely Dan from the Asia album, 1977, Black Cow. And, yeah, it is Friday on the front porch. The lines are open. Hang on a minute. Yeah, just checking. Lines are open. Jump right in if you wish, and we'll go until such time as we have folks on the traditional phone lines. We'll go to the Skype group, and it's Horn Malloy Skype group roll call. Good evening. Good evening, Sparky.
Good evening, Bob.
How are you? Evening, Jeremy. Hey, Waggy.
Come on. Hey there.
Sergi is with us with his brand new avatar of him standing with Wendy Davis. Nice snap, Sergi. And Jay Cruzen joins us.
Yeah, I'm here.
Howdy, howdy, howdy.
Howdy. You got me thinking about black cows now. I'll never look at my neighbors the same way.
Oh, I think we've got people thinking in a lot of different directions. GK writing, I'm sure glad I'm a vegetarian, said, yum, yum. Now, if that's not a resounding advertisement for beef, it's what's for dinner. Well, I don't know what is. Mm-hmm. Diseased and unsound animals.
All we got in the pasture right now is one bull and two horses. The rest of the herd is elsewhere.
Other side of the mountain, or maybe at...
Other side of the ranch, maybe? I don't know.
Well, hopefully they're not at Rancho Food Prep of Petaluma.
No. Luckily, we got our own local butcher shop here. And I've seen how they prepare their meat. I mean... They get sides of beef, and then they butcher them right on site.
Yeah, that's, there's a little bit more of a, you hope, a personal investment. See, that's, it's the corporatization, it's the mechanization, it's the mass, you know, ingathering of the nature of these operations that seems to lead to the problems. You know. Cow groping, chicken stomping, that kind of thing.
Although with the drought, the price of beef may be lower this summer.
Oh, really? Why? Because people just had to get it to market to keep it from...
They won't be able to feed them.
Well, yeah.
I don't know. The rancher behind me irrigates, off a well, keep the pasture going. Some of these other people, the Bureau of Reclamation that runs Shasta Dam controls all the water that comes out of there. They just told the city of Redding they had to cut back 60% on the water that they take out of the Sacramento River.
So what are they going to do? They're going to flood the market with beef this year, and then next year all of them will be dead, and then the price will go up, right?
Yeah, that could happen. I'm just saying that the water crisis is going to be real here. I mean, the Bureau is cutting off a lot of the agricultural contracts for water.
So speaking of the drought and the weather, has anybody been paying attention to what's been going on the past couple of days in the Midwest? You had a massive cold front that left, and tornadoes came in behind it, and now they're going to have a big freeze again?
Yeah. Notice the tornadoes.
Tornadoes sucking up the snow that was still on the ground. That's really nice.
Am I coming in okay with my mic?
Yes, you are, Sergi.
Sound good, Sergi.
Okay. While it is rare, it does happen. You can have winter thunderstorms that produce snow, sleet, or whatever. And tornadoes. It's very rare, but it happens.
Well, you know what, Sergi? I don't think it's going to be very rare anymore.
I will give you that. The climate is changing. It's getting wackier.
Yeah, I noticed warnings out for Northwest Alabama, because I check in on them from time to time. I noticed warnings out for Northwest Alabama for straight line winds of 70 miles an hour. Now, to be fair, around the 1st of March is when you start thinking tornado season. But this is not yet the 1st of March now, is it?
Well, last year we had a big tornado in North Carolina, Bob. In January.
Yep.
And if you've been paying attention to the UK's weather, they're getting 100-mile-an-hour winds for seemingly no reason.
And 500-year floods, right?
Yeah. Just all of a sudden. Here you go. Have a 100-mile-an-hour windstorm. Oh, and guess what? They're saying get used to it because it's going to keep happening.
Yeah, see, I've got this... I don't think it quite qualifies as treatable yet, but this will be the second summer coming along since the derecho, and I'm now that it's happened once, I sit here, gee, I wonder if it's going to happen again. And I know for a fact that the power infrastructure of this state ain't ready for another one, because it wasn't ready for the first one either.
Well, it's just getting kind of crazy. I mean, you got severe weather all across the middle and the eastern part of this country. At the same time that you're getting snowstorms back in behind it and in front of it. And California is so far in drought that one lightning strike is going to light the whole state on fire. Last year Australia had to add a new color to their damn weather map because it got so damn hot.
Here in Vermont, it's 50 today. It's been raining all day after it was, you know, probably 5 to almost 0 most of last month. And by Monday, it will be below 0 again.
Yeah, like I said, we got up to 70 yesterday, and I guess, by next week we'll be down in the deep freeze?
They're saying by Monday it'll be freezing weather here again with snow on the ground, even though it's all melting around right now. Which we got a foot last week, so basically all this snow is melting, turning into rainwater, going into the rivers, flooding people's basements, flooding culverts, and then it's going to get suddenly cold snap and just turn everything to a sheet of ice. It's wonderful, but there's no global warming, so stop talking about it. Just never mind.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but and at the same time, if you look at the jet stream, you look at the temperatures on the, I was just on the Weather Channel looking at a few maps, it's going to be warmer in Alaska in the next couple of days than it's going to be in the Northeast.
Well, come on, it snowed in Egypt last month. Yes, it happens very rarely, but, I mean, visible snow.
Yeah, Alaska's going to be in the 50s and the 60s, and the Northeast is going to be back down in the... teens.
Well, just got a note from GK in Minnesota. Yesterday we had an inch of rain, ice, thunder, 45-mile-an-hour plus wind gusts, then 8 inches of snow on top of all that. Come on, spring. I'd be careful with the come on spring, GK, because, don't know what's coming next. I mean, frogs, locusts, rivers of blood, who knows? No, wait, the blood's, according to the USDA, the blood is frozen. Oh! Nice.
Speaking of those plagues, Bob, I heard not too long ago that they're starting to think they found at least a couple historical figures who they can trace to possibly being the Moses character the Bible speaks of, even though his name wasn't even close to Moses. And they both were, I'm losing my mind here, Egyptian pharaohs. And both of them just suddenly disappeared off the map around the time when these stories supposedly happened. There are references to them, but their carvings and stuff have been all etched out of the stone by pharaohs after them.
Oh, Akhenaten's one of them. Because they defaced he and his wife's images. He's the one that tried to turn Egypt toward monotheism.
Isn't he the one that actually was an architect, too? Because that's the one I'm speaking of. I think that's him. And, yeah, basically I think he might have been the Moses character that people have throughout history have spoken about, even though, like I said, his name wasn't Moses.
Moses, Moses, Moses. Who is this Moses? I am thinking this Moses shall have been a fool. I always loved that line from The King and I. We've got folks waiting on the phone lines. Let's bring them aboard. Hey, welcome to Friday on the Front Porch.
Hello, hey.
Hello, hey, MJ. Stand by. Welcome to Friday on the Front Porch.
Well, hello there, everyone.
There's Kevin, Colorado Springs, checking in.
And by the way, we had winds up to 60 miles an hour last night and part of the day today. Even though I had my heat on in the apartment, it got down to 67 in here because the wind was just too strong to keep up with the heat. And these are insulated apartments, but apparently not that insulated. So, anyway, 67 wasn't too bad, but had I not had the heat on, I dread to think what it would have got down to, you know, just from the wind itself. And we got some snow, and I think we're good through the weekend until Monday. But, yeah, the weather, it's not just weird. It's been intensely unpredictable, I guess is the right word. That's the only word I can use to describe it. And while I haven't lost power through any of these windstorms, we've had a fairly significant amount of minor damage, if you could call any damage minor, when a tree limb falls on your car, you know. So, but we've had a lot of those reports of damage from not just this storm, but the previous two that have hit us in the past 2 weeks. And so, anyway, I give you a short weather report from the Springs, and that's probably what you're enduring down there in Texas today, Sergi, is the results of this cold front coming your way now.
It wasn't too windy today. Yesterday was the day it was extremely windy, and we had a red flag warning. There was, I think it was either high or extreme fire danger. Fortunately, nothing big broke out, but, you know, had someone, you know, parked their car on the grass and a spark fell down. Yeah, with all that wind blowing, the dry air, it could have turned nasty down here.
Anybody wearing red shoes?
No houses dropped on anybody?
No, but I don't want to go to Kansas anyway.
I'll be glad to make a prediction, and you guys can quote me on this one.
Okay, let's get the papers out and write this down.
All right, it's not going to be too long.
Let me get
if you live long enough, if you're young enough to see it, you're probably within the next, I don't know, 50 to 80 years. Might take 100. Might take less than that, seeing as how fast things are changing that climate scientists weren't expecting. I would predict that everybody understands that the ocean currents move the jet stream around, right? You know, you got warm air in the oceans, it warms the atmosphere, blah, 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 this and everything else. I predict a almost flat jet stream within the next 60 to 80 years. Might take 100. And then you're going to see the ice creeping down from the north and up from the south. And everything in the north and the south is going to be frozen. And you're going to just have straight line fucking winds all the way around the globe. Everything else is going to burn.
Jason, that is highly unlikely with all due respect. That is extremely highly unlikely.
Alright, well, you just think about, Sergi, just think about what's going to happen when we keep dumping all this fresh water from the melting Arctic. You know that we've only raised like 1 degree centigrade on average, you know, in our area. But the Arctic and the Antarctic, they're pushing up to 20 degrees above average. That's a big freaking deal.
Oh, yeah, I mean, climate change overall is a big freaking deal, Jason, but the kind of scenario you're explaining is not going to happen. It's climate's going to change. It's going to get wackier. That's not going to happen. That's because, you know, the oceans are still going to be here. They may be polluted. They may be diluted. But
there may be more of them.
That's
the other thing, though, is the currents control the climate. Once you shut the currents off by flooding them with fresh water...
The currents aren't going to shut off, Jason. They're just going to weaken and change.
Gentlemen, I think it's the desalinization of the water that's going to cause more climate change than anything else, not necessarily the volume of the water.
Yeah, and then once they start warming up, then all the methane is going to be released.
You know, I mean, the thing that's about it is there's a lot of water locked up in the ice caps. However, there's a lot more water in the already here oceans. So it's currents will weaken, they'll change, some of them will strengthen even, depending on where they are, and the climate will change, but there will be no burning hot middle, you know, unnaturally cold poles. I mean, you know, it's not going to happen.
Well, this brings into account a story that I posted over on the Horn site from where did it come from? DSmog blog. Love that blog. This is one of those science questions. If one is attempting to do science based on data, of course, science has to be based on data. What happens if the data upon which one is relying turns out to be radically wrong? And I'm not going all denier on anybody. In fact, this DSmog blog post is really, really creepy. It references a study published in the journal Science called Methane Leakage from North American Natural Gas Systems. 16 researchers from institutions like Stanford, MIT, the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, worked together, and what they found out is that the estimates of total North American methane leaks that have been estimated by the EPA, whom Idaho hates, and Joe Manchin, that they are... between 25 and 75% too low. In other words, doesn't that mean that anything that was based upon those EPA estimates of total North American methane leaks is also going to yield a result that is also abnormally low? Or incorrectly low?
Well, it depends on how important... those results are to whatever the hypothesis and conclusion are, but also keep in mind if we're talking about global climate, the U.S. is only a very small percentage of the entire world.
That's true. I agree. But insofar as these are estimates regarding methane leaks, and given the fact that methane leaks are that methane is 86 times more more effective greenhouse gas, and if we're estimating it this wrong here, what's that say? I mean, to the extent that it's being estimated elsewhere, what does that say?
That it's an estimate with a larger error than was originally assumed. All estimates have errors.
Sure.
And still, if you're looking at the total global balance, though, it may or may not be significant.
Maybe we have flawed data.
Well, that's what this looks like. In my reading of it, that you know the EPA data is flawed. It's based on a review of 200 different studies of natural gas leaks across North America. And essentially what DSmog blog says is that it means that methane leaks are far more dangerous to the climate than the Obama administration has thus far let on. That's the conclusion they're drawing. I mean, I understand margins of error, I think. If you're talking, look at polling data. You know, the margin of error was 4.9%, but not if it's a margin of error between 25 and 75%, that's pretty much nothing but error, isn't it? Or very nearly.
It's not unusual in environmental sciences. You know, what's the error on the methane that's released from the prairie, or other large uninhabited areas? There is some that's released, and then also methane that's released when from deforestation. We can't even accurately estimate the amount of deforestation going on, and I don't know how many studies have been done taking a look at the amount of methane released from it. There's a ton of carbon released overall. Those kind of error margins are not that unusual in environmental and looking at global mass balances. Because we really don't know how this planet works. We're just screwing with it.
There's a massive amount of methane that is what, for lack of a better term, people would say frozen on the ocean floor that's going to start releasing itself.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we don't really know how much those are, and except that there's a almost unimaginable amount, and there are always people who are extremely scared that it's all just going to suddenly sublimate and come out of solution or out of the state it's in, and it could. That's another thing we don't know about. The stuff that goes on under the ocean, we know less about than what goes on in space, near space.
And then the other thing I'm talking about, all the fresh water flooding into the oceans, as it goes back to you, Sergi. That's what caused Snowball Earth. Now I don't know if you're familiar with that, but you might want to go back and check your history.
Jason, I am.
Because when you shut the ocean currents off, that's what happened. We turned into a big-ass snowball.
I am fully aware of Snowball Earth, Jason. I'm a weather buff. I know about this stuff, but the currents are not going to shut off.
And the salinity of the ocean has been increasing over time for, since the ocean began. So if it goes back to a state of, 10 or 20 or 30,000 years ago, or 100,000 years ago, that's not as different as some of the other stuff that we're doing to the planet.
Either way, if that study, and I tend to believe it, just looking at the weather over the past 6 months, much less the past year or two, I think we're in an accelerated state of climate change, global warming. I don't care what you call it. It's happening. And so if that, people were estimating that the full effects of climate change, global warming, would be within the next 25 to 50 years. Well, if that study is 75% wrong, just take the high end of it, that pretty much means that we're right at the edge of that climate change hitting us full force. And I think that's what's happening. I mean, we get the Chinook winds out here. There's always a season, early spring, late summer, when we get these dry Chinook winds from the west. But what we've gotten this year hasn't necessarily been out of character, but the rapidity of them happening and followed by one day of extremely dry weather, humidity's in the 10-15% range, and then followed by snow and wind, and it's just, that's the only word I can, bizarre, some of it, not all of it, but there has just been periods of some bizarreness in the weather pattern. What's happening in New York, from Atlanta all the way up the East Coast this year, can you say that's normal weather? Not that it hasn't happened, but the number of the storms, the frequency, the severity of them especially. Would you call that normal?
No. Not at all. That cannot be denied.
Well, we've got, let's add one more member to the telephone group. That means we've got one line remaining for anyone who wants to get in on Friday on the front porch via the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, it's Dave.
Yeah, hey, Dave. Welcome to Friday on the front porch.
How you guys doing?
Hey, Dave.
How's everybody doing? Yeah. So you were talking about the storm. Yeah, we had some pretty rough weather a week back or so. We had heavy snow, and it all melted, but, I mean, yeah, I don't know what normal is anymore these days. What's normal?
Well, it certainly isn't. We do know it's still a setting on a dryer. I got a link in from Texas Betsy from Business Insider. Interesting little map, the annual Gallup ranking of happiest places in the United States is out. And this is weird. The happiest state in the union is North Dakota. With a well-being index score of 70.4. Let's see, 50, 49. Number 40. Hey, look, West Virginia. I got a feeling they must have compiled this data before the water got poisoned.
Hey,
do you think, Bob?
It takes a while to compile this stuff, doesn't it, Jim?
Lord have mercy, when you said that, I said, oh, Lord.
Because I don't think we rank 40 right now. I think 40 is pretty shameless optimism for West Virginia at this point in time.
I'll have to concur with you, sir.
And let's bring our fourth and final Friday on the front porch conversationalist on via the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening from Syracuse, Bob.
Hey, Dan, what's happening?
Same stuff. A lot of weather here, up and down. Zero a couple of days ago, 40, 50 today. Same stuff that everyone's been describing.
Hey, Dan,
how you doing? Used to this.
Can or can't?
I think we can expect this. It'll be the sine wave of the future.
Ooh. Well, I noticed something that Waggy, who was talking a minute ago, posted in the chat room just now. The greatest risk to humans lies in increased variability. We rely on predictable weather for food, transportation, water supplies, and pretty much everything.
Yeah.
And really, that is so essentially true, because the very first impulses of human sedentary society were geared toward trying to figure out when to get the seeds in the ground.
Sure.
Because if you get them in too early and they sprout and then they freeze and they die, hello, famine.
Yeah.
And, I mean, these efforts are predicated on trying to figure out how not to starve.
I keep flashing to that 129 degrees in Australia. Recently, that is preheated oven stuff right there.
Yeah, I mean that was the new color on the map, wasn't it?
And you know that damn ass Prime Minister of Australia says he doesn't believe in frickin' global climate change.
Oh no.
It was 129 in Australia.
Yeah.
Yeah. They had to make a new color on the weather map for it.
129. That was this season.
When did it get up to 129?
It was 2013. I think it was like August or September. I don't know. Their summer is different than ours, so.
Yeah, their summer is just now coming to an end.
Yeah, they're experiencing hot weather now. So I think it was around November, I believe, is when that story broke out. November last year. December, maybe.
Yeah.
Speaking of new colors on the weather map,
it ain't just for temperature. I've noticed that Channel 4 here has I don't hardly watch Channel 4 because it's our local Fox station, but you know, it was severe weather this past spring, and they were covering it, and I was just looking at all the coverage for all the stations, and their hail size map, because, you know, there's a derived product of NetSRAD weather radar called vertically integrated liquid, which is used to estimate hail size up in the clouds. And before, in past years, their hail size color legend chart thingy ended at grapefruit-sized hail, which, you know, does happen. You have grapefruit-sized hail, which is, or softballs. They're about the same size, so you know, whatever term they use, grapefruit. Well, just this year, they extended that legend, I guess in a just-in-case kind of thing, to bowling ball-sized hail.
You know what it was, the reference that got fired, nice. Got David Letterman fired as a weatherman in Indianapolis, right?
No. I didn't know David Letterman was ever a weatherman.
He absolutely was, and he was fired from his job in Indianapolis when he described hail the size of canned hams.
I was fired for that.
Yeah, okay. Oh, I'm laughing, but it's so tragic.
Let me ask an honest question here. Is there anybody in here in this group that believes we haven't already passed the tipping point?
Oh, I think we passed everything, pretty much everything worth passing, Jay Cruzen.
Which tipping point? There are several.
The tipping point where global climate change, global warming, whatever the hell you want to call it, becomes self-sustaining.
Oh, you mean the feedback loop?
Yeah, I think it's there.
Is there anybody that thinks we haven't?
No.
Not me.
No.
I mean, it kind of goes hand in hand, doesn't it? I mean, we've passed peak oil. I think here in Appalachia, we passed peak coal a long time ago, but I think globally we're probably passing that. And, one of the worst things that could have possibly happened to the planet was the technology that it allowed us to exploit, the hell shales, you know, miles beneath the surface of the earth.
Fracking.
Because fracking, that stuff is going to contribute dramatically to the increase in the problem. I mean, I can't get over, and I know maybe I'm like a broken record, but that whole Rolling Stone article from a few months ago, you know, Goodbye Miami, every now and then you'll see a map of what climate change is going to do, say, to North America. And it's the damnedest thing you ever saw.
Yeah, I got a few of those maps.
I got a short, good little story, if you want, for climate change.
Yeah?
We were still picking tomatoes at Thanksgiving. Rattle that around your head. It never got cold enough to kill the plants.
And where are you? Is that in California?
Northern California.
Okay.
Far northern Sacramento Valley.
I was able to overwinter tomatoes a couple of years when I had a garden.
But usually we get a cold snap around the end of October that kills the plants off.
Yeah, we usually get frosts, and, you know, hard frosts and some freezes too, but there were a couple of years that we didn't. And, oh, were the bugs bad the next spring?
Well, that map that shows, you know, Florida, gone, much of the Caribbean, gone, the bayous of Mississippi, Louisiana, and Alabama, and East Texas, gone, and a Mississippi Delta that's somewhere in Arkansas. Goodbye Boston, goodbye New York, goodbye Baltimore, goodbye North Carolina coastline, south. Goodbye, Charleston.
Well, Bob?
Get your beachfront real estate now while it's cheap.
I guess I'm sitting on an acre of it here, aren't I?
Does anybody know anything about ants?
Yeah, well, I can tell you about fleas because we had such a mild winter last year that the fleas were here in overabundance. And normally that's not the case because they're killed off. But it was real bad here.
We got these little ant holes opening up all over the yard, you know, where they tunnel out of the ground and leave just dirt everywhere. And then they leave it and they go make another one or something. So I don't know what's going on, but I've never seen it seen them do that before all over the place. Usually
sounds like you got a new ant that's moved up from the south to the north as the climate changes. The species moved to the north.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, it's probably a new one. We got new ants here too, which are actually putting the imported fire ant population down. So it's not so much a bad thing.
Are you referring to the crazy raspberry ants, Wagner?
Them's the ones.
Yep.
wait, stop. Huh? What? Raspberry ants?
Crazy ants.
Crazy raspberry ants.
No, that's really the name. Stop it.
That's really the name because the dude who first noticed that they moved up from the tropics to Texas, his last name was Raspberry, R-A-S-B-E-R-R-Y. So I'm not sure if he wanted this to happen or not, but his name became associated with the ants. They are called crazy because unlike other ants that march in neat little lines and, you know, do such like that, these ants constantly are in frenzy mode. So they are all over the place.
Oh, okay.
They don't go in lines. They swarm.
Well, Sergi, seeing as how you're in Texas and you're closest to South America there, just wait until you get the Siafu.
What now? What is that?
The Siafu ants.
No. Oh, please. Oof. Yeah, I've seen these documentaries about tropical ants. Oof. Yeah, I mean, the crazy raspberries just moved into North Texas about three years ago.
Yeah, at this point, there's fire ants.
The fire ants are
guilty for killing several people. They kill people. They eat chickens, they eat snakes, they eat lizards, they eat frogs, they eat everything.
Yeah, fire ants have killed people,
they'll
too.
Take you down and kill you.
Yeah, a fire ant, you know, one or a small several might bite you at once. These crazy ants, you'll get bitten dozens of times.
Yeah, but they don't
have the rattlesnake venom that the fire ants do.
Yeah, that is one thing to their credit.
By the way, we've just received a dispatch from Robert in Australia. Subject line: Prime Minister Tony Abbott. Robert informs us he's a devout Catholic. You'd never know it from his politics. Hottest temperatures so far are reported from Udnadatta, South Australia, where temperatures climbed to 129 degrees Fahrenheit. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Abbott is an adamant climate denier and friend of industry, famous for his aphorism, "Climate change is absolute crap," and that was said in 2009. Robert notes, here in Sydney, where I live, we've had consecutive days of 110 degrees Fahrenheit, and that felt like an oven. Goodness knows what 129 feels like. And I've checked the sea level rise maps. I could end up living a short walk from the beach. Currently, it's about 10 kilometers away.
Well, here in Texas, the summers of 2010 and 2011, it wasn't the ambient temperature, it was the heat index, factoring the ambient temperature and the humidity, and we had several days where the heat index touched 130.
And, well, I mean, I remember from my one foray down there last September, remember September 15th, and, you know, Jesus, it was more a product of my ignorance than anything else, but my God, it was hot. And this is coming from a kid who grew up in Alabama. I was expecting some sort of, you know, dry heat, but that, again, that's my geographic ignorance. That's not the climate or, you know, bad weather. But no. And see that the what's fascinating out of all of this is that all of this population shift in a sort of somewhat orderly migration is a result of the invention of air conditioning. Now, what happens to these hot areas that are getting hotter? If the things that enable that go sideways. I mean, I'm not saying that the aliens are going to come and take all of our air conditioning or anything, but there, you know, there are certain things that air conditioning relies upon. And I don't know about when it gets real hot down there, but it got cold enough here that our coal-fired power grid, we got warnings from Appalachian Power saying, please turn your thermostats down, turn some lights off, try not to use so much electricity because this aging ancient grid that we have here can't stand the strain. And of course the storms blew through last night and several thousand West Virginians were knocked out of power. You know, oh well, right? What I think I'm getting afraid of is that, and it's not, you know, it's not just bad weather or weather events. It's when you have these events and they are coupled with a political climate in Washington, D.C. and in the various state houses, see Idaho, that wants to engage in not just climate change denial, but denial of the very idea that government is something worth having. I mean, consider the West Virginia water crisis. There's nobody passing out water anymore, or if they are, it's in very limited amounts. And this is all because, for instance, GERT decided to take the word of West Virginia American Water Company, a for-profit outfit that is dedicated to its shareholder share prices, and not so much to its infrastructure, kind of the way it is with Appalachian Power. And consequently, FEMA will not step back in, even though through these documents that I was talking about at the beginning of the program, we know that the shit is still in the water. And so when you, that's your perfect storm. Weather-related crises coupled up with a government that is at least in part run by people who think the job of government is to cease existing.
Yeah, well, you're supposed to just be a good frickin' American. Drink your damn water. To hell with what everybody else thinks.
Yeah, send the little old ladies out to Target to buy their little swimmer's goggles so they won't burn their septuagenarian eyes when they try to take a bath. Why not?
Ah, they'll be all right. They'll be all right. Just
sure. Yeah, cue up Lee Greenwood and send him to the showers. They can sit there with their eyeballs burning while they sing, and I'm glad to be an American. Jesus. And meanwhile, Joe Manchin, the guy who says he's an environmentalist, isn't doing a damn thing to help people who still badly need relief. I mean, what kind of, and I'm kind of asking you to step into some people's shoes here. We as modern people, particularly, well, at least in this country, and I know the other ones that are civilized as well, within the meaning of the, whatever the meaning of that word means, we are, for instance, fond of bathing. What do you do when you desperately want a bath or a shower, but you know that stepping out of the bath, stepping into it and then stepping out of it, you may step out of it with some sort of god-awful rash burning all over your skin? What do you do when it's 6 weeks of that? And I don't know who we go to for answers. Do we ask the people of the lower Ninth Ward who survived Katrina? Are they the ones who might best be able to tell us? Or people who survived Sandy? I mean, I'm not trying to sound freaked out about this, except for the fact that, well, I'm kind of freaked out. I'm not in. I'm not in one of the affected counties, but you know these are A, my fellow West Virginians, and B, my fellow Americans. So, the Obama administration has been as quiet as the tomb about all of this. Has he said one word?
Not that I know of.
I haven't heard anything.
Joe Manchin says that even though he hates the EPA, he wants to work with them. And has Joe Manchin gotten out of the shower with a damn chemical burn on his skin?
Oh, I hate to see that.
Well, yeah, that's kind of a bad visual there, Jim. My apologies.
That's all right, but I think Joe Manchin's not taking showers here.
No.
It's fair to say that Gert does not live in one of the nine counties. Is that correct?
No, Gert does live in one of the nine counties.
He does. So he's one of the 300,000 affected.
I don't know. I don't know what kind of sacred cow treatment the governor of the state of West Virginia gets.
Yeah.
I got you. Bet he's got several National Guard water buffaloes around his place.
Yeah. See, I wouldn't be surprised.
Mm-hmm. Do you believe he's not being affected?
You know what else, though, Bob? That's just a micro issue. The whole macro issue is that we shouldn't be using coal to begin with. It needs to go away, period. Point blank. Every fossil fuel needs to go away, and if it doesn't, we're going to kill ourselves. We probably already have anyway.
Well, I mean, I certainly think there's truth in your statement, Jay Cruz.
I mean, seriously, if we don't stop now, hell, if we didn't stop 20 years ago, we already destroyed our future generations. There's a good chance that we're past the tipping point. We're going to destroy our future generations. And that horror story in West Virginia, and yes, it is a horror story. It's just going to happen over and over in other places, but it's still just a micro, and the macro is that we have to stop. And if we don't, you know what? Look your children in the eye. Just go ahead and try. If we don't.
Yeah, we sure can't count on government, though, to do anything, I don't believe, anymore.
We can't count on this government. We can't count on this government, no.
No. Well, not yet. I think the government we have now is just completely paralyzed by the interests of the rich. They're not going to do anything for anybody under any circumstances. It seems looking that way more and more.
And think about the pressure on the environment when the as we go forward, the 2. Whatever it is, billions of people in China and India alone that have already said, this is our time. We want our cars and our air conditioners, and the kind of pressure that's going to put on the planet. So, Jay, I completely agree with you. We should have stopped decades ago, turned this big horse around, because like any big ocean-going vessel, it takes a while for that thing to be...
I think it's been somewhere around 700,000 to a million years between now, which we're at 400 parts per million, mm-hmm. of carbon dioxide, and the last time that the Earth saw that.
Yeah.
And it was a freaking oven last time.
Yeah. I read recently that we can expect temperatures as high as and possibly in excess of 11 degrees centigrade.
Here it is. This goes back to May 12th of 2013. Here we go. The last time CO2 levels hit 400 parts per million on planet Earth, according to Joe Rahm, who is very, very good at what he does, was, let's see here, well before humans emerged on the planet, from a study in the journal Science again. One of our major findings is that the Arctic was very warm in the Pliocene 5.3 to 2.6 million years ago, when others have suggested atmospheric CO2 was very much like levels we see today. This could tell us where we are going in the near future. In other words, the Earth system response to small changes in carbon dioxide is bigger than suggested by earlier models. So, yeah, the middle Pliocene documentation of sustained warmth with summer temperatures about 59 to 61 degrees Fahrenheit, about 8 degrees warmer than today. And it is what they describe as absolutely new knowledge. The 1.2 million years when the West Antarctic ice sheet did not exist. And sea levels during the mid-Pliocene were about 25 meters higher than they are today.
It's 75 feet, right?
Wow. 25
yeah.
meters.
Yep.
Yeah, that's
more than 75 feet.
Yeah, that's with CO2 levels at 400 parts per million.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're toast. I don't know. Things are happening much faster than all the forecasts are coming back at us. I don't think it'll be more than 2 or 3 years before things start to really change big time. Well, they're changing now. We're in the middle of it. But I'm saying that,
Well, what scares the shit out of me is that within my children's life, we may see that 25 meter rise again. I think everybody's underestimated this whole thing.
Well, that was my earliest point. The only uncertainty in the climate change models is how badly it was underestimated.
The scientists deliberately underestimated with their models because they didn't want to be seen as
alarmist.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
Well, when that word alarmist, we've all got a pretty rock solid functioning understanding of the English language. That word alarmist comes from alarm. And the alarm is what you sound when the town, when the city is on fire, right?
Yes.
So is the first person who rings the bell when the village catches fire, is that person an alarmist who says the village is on fire?
No. I've just got a question, if I may ask, please.
Go ahead, Jim.
I mean, are these rates, are they arithmetic, geometric, or exponential?
Exponential, I believe.
Yeah, once you get into the feedback loop.
Which we're in.
Yeah, I think there are a number of feedback loops, but we're passing these signposts. Like, once that Arctic ice sheet is gone, things are going to go up, temperatures are going to go up very fast and for a very long time, and it's not going to be like going to the supermarket. And even if you could get Hot Pockets, wanted them, you couldn't get them. they won't be there. Nothing will be there.
I'm guessing 10 years and Greenland ice sheet's gone.
In January of 2011, the journal Science reported, on our current emissions path, CO2 levels in the year 2100 will hit levels last seen when the Earth was 29 degrees Fahrenheit hotter. Paleoclimate data suggests CO2 may have at least twice the effect on global temperatures than currently projected by computer models.
Bob, what type of animals were padding about at that time?
Well, the fact that they were padding probably tells us a little bit about that, doesn't it, Jim?
There wasn't much of anything, Jim.
Well, I don't think
you're talking about the Carboniferous period back then.
No, I was just asking Bob the question. I mean, what could survive?
No, I mean, I'm not criticizing you. I'm just saying I don't think there wasn't much around.
I mean, you had
maybe some rats and possums.
I mean, it's like Venus.
No,
not quite.
No. That would have been closer to the Carboniferous period, okay, where pretty much all you had was plant life.
According to Wikipedia, fauna of the mid-Pliocene Both marine and continental faunas were essentially modern, although continental faunas were a bit more primitive than today. And it's in the Pliocene that the first recognizable hominids, the Australopithecines, appeared.
I see.
Let's see. One graphic here shows mammoths, llamas, beavers. One of my particular favorites, the giant ground sloth, who had a claw the length of your arm. Parrots, tapirs, bunnies, saber-toothed tigers,
giant turkeys,
and that
7 foot tall.
Yeah, that horse that started out.
That's a terrier.
Hippo something or another. And then went extinct. I mean, there was life here, undeniably. But you'll notice there aren't a lot of giant ground sloths around either.
Hey, Bob, thinking about the life that there is today, what do you think would still be around if you add 30 degrees to your average temperature, Fahrenheit?
Not a bunch.
What type of life do we have right now that would still be around in that temperature?
I'm not. You know what? I got to back up here because there's something that bugs me about that statement that Australopithecines were around in the Pliocene epoch. That sounds crazy.
Well, I thought so too, Bob. To tell you the truth.
What is that?
They were like tiny monkeys, weren't they?
No. These are recognizable things that are on their way to human.
Hominids. They walked upright.
But this is okay.
To give you an idea, this is during the era, and I'm just pulling stuff at random. It's described as being the era during which the continents were all slammed together. So I guess sort of Pangaea?
Yeah, Pangaea, before everything started sliding apart as we know it today.
It must have been a huge Earth mass. Way before any human or hominids were on the planet then.
No, I know. That was right after the Snowball Earth, actually.
So, I don't know. Well, the interweb tubes are a dangerous toy to play with when you're trying to... Oh, by the way, Irish Dave said, padding about? Wolverines!
thinking about those dangerous ants.
Ellen, thanks going out to Sal, who has gotten us started on fundraising for this evening. We are we're at $125 that we need to raise before week's end so that we don't start Monday in a hole. Thank you, Sal. Thank you very much. Irish Dave pointing out, there will always be wolverines, two also weasels. Lots and lots of weasels, apparently.
Yeah, I kind of disagree with the thought that we'll go back to the Pliocene. I think we're on track for the Carboniferous. Just the amount of material that we're burning, I just don't see how.
But well, we're gonna.
We wouldn't need that back there.
I agree completely. I'm thinking Carboniferous myself. The only problem with the Carboniferous, Devin, is that we've cut down all the damn rainforests.
See, that's the thing. Those are, the large plant life of the Carboniferous period, the megafauna, as it were. Are an evolutionary response to a massive amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. So you get these, and you'd have to go into a coal mine to see them, or you can see them in museums. You know, the trunks of, giant damn ferns with tree trunks size of oak trees.
What gets me, though, is we're going to skip right past that because we've destroyed the damn plant life that could actually prosper from the CO2 that's being put into the atmosphere. So then where does that leave us?
Well, but if you assume that once we're gone, things are going to fill back in.
Right, right. We won't be there to cut anything down anymore. No more strip mining and clear cutting.
Is it possible that the Earth can create those plants to actually absorb it again?
Sure.
Or are we just
plants will survive.
Sea pods. I mean, what?
Yeah, there'll be a void when we're gone. When we're gone, there'll be a void.
Let me ask you something, gentlemen. What is the
right? That all depends on us going away really quickly.
Go ahead, Jim.
We will.
What is the rate of destruction of the rainforest? So many hundreds of acres per day or hour. I haven't heard anything about that recently, but I know there.
I've heard there's a huge drought in Brazil. They're having a horrible drought there. They're running out. It's like California. They're running out of water over there. So it could be very fast. It could be exponential again.
You know, it's just terrible when they destroy rainforests because, it's just incredible what those forests could contain as far as medicines and things of that nature and all types of cures for a lot of things. In other words, those rainforests were put here for a reason or are there for a reason, and it's just incredible how they are just, through slash and burn technique.
Okay, Jim.
Destroy.
Jim, I don't want to interrupt you, but I got an answer for your question right now. 100,000 acres every day.
100,000 acres.
All you really got to do is go to Google Maps and Google Earth and do the history on it over the Amazon basin, and it'll just blow your mind.
That's what I thought. I mean, I haven't really heard many figures about that, and people have been keeping it quiet, but they used to basically do reports on that. No longer are they doing that.
Well, I read somewhere
there can't be much left.
In the last 2 years, over the last summer, I read somewhere that the Amazon actually put out more carbon than it took in last year because of the drying and the drought they're having there and wildfires they're having there, and once all that fauna dies or the flora dies, whatever, it's going to put out that carbon that it's sequestering, so it's going to. It's another feedback loop, another positive feedback. Is when
One thing I did see, it was a documentary about how these people are going in there in an effort to locate, of all things, more gold, and they're destroying things like you would not believe, as far as the forests are concerned, the rainforest.
Well, isn't this the downhill race, Jim? Isn't this the model that you see playing out in the case of resource scarcity?
Yeah, I mean, all the triple canopies will be gone soon.
Wow. Yeah. Folks,
there will be no more quick mansions.
Down in the Amazon, they're still using mercury on the gold dredges out in the Amazon to collect the little flakes of gold from their sluices, and they're pouring mercury right into the sluice water to coagulate with the gold, and the extra water just flows right into the Amazon.
Yeah, that's what I was referring to and how deleterious it would be.
I got this website, guys, that you might want to check out. It's rainforestmaker.org. And if you go all the way to the bottom of it, there's a clock. It's a deforestation, forest planting, renewable energy, carbon sequestration, and forest products. And there's little clocks that run. Once you log on, it tells you how many hectares lost since you freaking logged on, forest planting since you logged on, renewable energy since you blah, blah, blah. It's kind of astounding, though.
May I have a name?
Watch that website, that deforestation clock runs a hell of a lot faster than the forest planting.
Is that what it's called, deforestation clock?
Yeah.
Rainforestmaker.org.
Rainforestmaker.org.
Thank you.
I just stumbled across this.
Well, by the way, since we are sitting here talking about climate change, you might be interested to know that Godwin's law has taken another beating. Yeah. Because whether you realize it or not, we're all Nazis.
Okay.
Daggummit, and I try so hard not to be. According to climate change skeptic doctor, and of course he couldn't put a Band-Aid on without killing somebody, Roy W. Spencer, he objects to being called a global warming denier because calling people deniers constitutes being a global warming Nazi. This guy used to work for NASA. Let's see. Here's what he said in his blog post. When politicians and scientists started calling people like me deniers, they crossed the line. They are still doing it. They indirectly equate, one, the skeptic's view that global warming is not necessarily all man-made nor a serious problem, with, two, the denial that the Nazis' extermination of millions of Jews ever happened. Too many of us for far too long have ignored the repulsive extremist nature of the comparison. It's time to push back. I'm now going to start calling these people global warming Nazis.
Perhaps there's a reason he, quote, unquote, used to work for NASA.
Oh, God. Let's see. Like Nazis, they are... Wait. It gets better. Like the Nazis, they advocate the supreme authority of the state, fascism, which in turn supports their scientific research to support their cause. In the 1930s, it was superiority of the white race. Like the Nazis, they are anti-capitalist. They are willing to sacrifice millions of lives of poor people at the altar of radical environmentalism, advocating expensive energy policies that increase poverty. And if there is a historically demonstrable threat to humanity, it is poverty. Anybody want to guess where this guy teaches? Yes, he's a teacher.
Oh, do you have his address, please? Go ahead. Give
no, somebody said... No, we had a guess in there. Who said what university?
Liberty.
Yeah.
Bob Jones.
Wrong on both counts. He teaches at the University of Alabama Stan in Huntsville.
Well, that was not too far away from his work with NASA, right?
Well, there's that and the fact that a bunch of unreconstructed Nazis built the space program in Huntsville.
Yeah, I was just thinking that, but I don't want to say it.
While I'm polishing and cleaning my Mossberg shotgun, I just can't figure out where to go first. And that kind of qualifies as a good place to start.
Let's see. He says, this authoritarianism tends to happen with an overeducated elite class. I have read that Nazi Germany had more PhDs per capita than any other country. I'm not against education, but it seems like some of the stupidest people are also the most educated.
Over-educated.
Yeah, and he said this, of course, being absolutely oblivious to the great offering he had just made to the goddess of irony.
Well, you know, Bob, it was just incredible to believe. I mean, in Germany, for example, having all these PhDs, some of the theories they had about the origins of the world, the ice thing, and all this kinds of stuff, and as far as the PhDs in Germany are concerned in the 30s, they certainly picked the right ones to drive out, didn't they?
It depends on which side of the mushroom cloud you're on, Jim.
Well, I mean, I was just thinking of a number of, for example, at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute, they were working pretty hard on a lot of things that led to the nuclear age. And, of course, you know, if they had kept Albert Einstein and some of the others who, you know, left, I think the history of the world would have been a lot different.
Yeah, I think there's probably truth in that. Hey, I direct this to the folks who are on the phone side of this. We've got Pam on hold, and she'd like to come into the discussion, but I don't have any spaces open. Would anybody volunteer to take one for the team so Pam can come into the conversation?
Yes, I'll take one for the team, Bob.
Oh, well, I appreciate it.
Hello to Pam, and good night, gentlemen.
All right, take care.
And ladies.
Good night. And ladies.
Get your butt in Skype and get in
Tracy.
Here.
Hi.
Yeah, there's Tracy. Okay, let's bring Pam on board. Are you there, Pam?
Hi.
Hi.
Yes, I am.
Yay.
Hi.
Welcome.
Thank you. Look, I'm calling from Wisconsin, Bob.
Oh, wonderful.
I actually emailed you earlier today for your phone number because I lost your cell phone number, and then I didn't even realize this was the radio program phone number because it just kept ringing every time I called.
I answer it when I'm back here.
Okay. And
the
problem is
it doesn't have a ringer attached to it, so I have no way of knowing if I'm not looking at the little blinking lights.
And I didn't know what time the show ended, so whatever. You guys are talking all over the place. And you're talking about what's going to happen when we're beyond a point of no return or when there's no people. And I think that there's actually a lot of stuff that can be done, but that's according to other realms, kind of. Meaning, well, even in this realm, there's technology that's not being shared. For instance, you're talking about the Amazon. Northwestern University, by mistake, just developed a gold separation process. I think it's just with baking soda. They had a mistake in the lab, and they saw that the gold separated. So you don't need arsenic anymore, but none of the mining companies are using it. There's other technologies that have been developed. I'm sure you're aware of some of them along the way, including the diesel engine, and all types of things that, you know, were in existence or are in existence that are not developed by industry. So there are things, you know, that exist now, and then in a very practical sense, and then there's stuff like Native American oral traditions, oral stories, indigenous science, indigenous ways of knowing. There's that realm, so I can just throw those two topics out.
Well, I think you raised something, Pam, that is viable for discussion, and that is, we have seen the human population dwindle to less. I mean, we know this. That at one point in time, the human population of planet Earth was somewhere around 2,500 individuals. And from that, we spread all over the planet. I don't think complete human extinction is a likelihood. Frankly, we're kind of hard to kill off. But the larger question is one of what happens when, for instance, I think Bill and I were talking last night about Barbara Tuchman's book, A Distant Mirror, which is her take on the 14th century. And what happens when population levels are reduced enough that stuff just doesn't work anymore? And that's, you know, depending on what your particular view of human nature is, that's when you get into, you know, Mad Max land. Interestingly, however, it was the one-third of the population dying off in the Black Plague that led to the rise of humanism, the Renaissance, and the birth of the so-called modern world.
Right.
Because the feudal system collapsed. For the most part,
Bob,
at least in Western Europe.
Wait a minute. You look at today, it doesn't look like we learned a goddamn thing from that, though.
I mean, wasn't that just a transfer from merchant to industrialist? Really?
We're right back there again, Bob. I mean, we didn't learn a damn thing from it.
I don't think you can say we didn't learn anything from it.
Okay.
We forgot a lot of things too.
Maybe next go around, huh?
Recipe for cement.
No, I agree with Bob on that. About we did learn things from it. It's those who are in power that chose, that are choosing not to keep, not to look to enforce or not just keep the lessons learned because they know what's going wrong, but it's not to their better interest to care.
Well, or Tracy, they simply have different interests. Their interests are acquisition.
Which makes, you know, they, which makes they,
we're going,
throw the
we're going
away.
Back into a gilded age with the where the divide between the haves and have nots are getting larger and larger and larger. So, you know, they're learning, they learned a lot from what happened before, and they're putting it into, they just learned the lessons better and how to bamboozle people even better.
Tracy, let's remember, you know, for instance, I raised the issue of the plague. You know, that raged all the way from the Asian coast all the way across Eurasia, India, and all the way to Western Europe, and wiped out a third of the population of those continents.
And Bob, you know, it destroyed the feudal system, as you said, and all these people who used to sit on their estates, well, they lost all their workers, and they had to come out and do the manual work that the people who had died had done before, right?
Precisely. There was, and that enabled, that part of the collapse of the feudal system, Jim, lay in the fact that working people, people who worked the land, suddenly had a little bit more power in their hands than they had theretofore had, which, of course, leads to, for instance, the Parisian riots of the Jacquerie, who were slaughtered wholesale for daring to stand up against entrenched power. This is the, you know, I mean, this is the kind of, this is the kind of stuff that happens. But by counterpoint, let's remember that all of this time, the Western Hemisphere, North and South and Central America, and the island groups, were supporting the highest population levels on the planet. And we're doing so successfully and sustainably. And so, I'm sorry, Pam, go ahead.
Native Americans will tell you there was a hell of a lot more people here before Christopher than people let on.
I mean,
the land was highly managed for a very large population.
Yeah, it was the population of North and South and Central America was higher than that of Europe and Asia in 1491.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I mean, you had your ebbs and flows of cultural success and failure. The Mayan people deforested themselves literally right out of a civilization. But by and large. The population remained pretty steady and pretty healthy.
Okay, but there's a little bit of a difference, Bob. What we're doing now is we're affecting the planet in a way that the planet is going to kill off billions and billions of people.
But it's not going to create I don't think it's going to be an extinction event.
Well, whether it is or not, it's not going to ease up. Not within, I don't know. How many hundreds of thousands of years did it take to go from 400 or 500 parts per million CO2 down to
all those times you're talking about
where we began to be prosperous?
Well, it depends on how you define prosperity. You can argue, I wish Dr. John was here, because there are certain biases that are in place with regard to human cultural development that say that, I can almost imagine the email coming from Ron in Raleigh right now. Oh, next on the EIB. No, you're never going to hear Rush talking about this. But there are certain biases inherent in sedentary agricultural society that may not necessarily be valid. I mean, it was a very long time ago that studies of the bush folk of the Kalahari led to, and I think it was the Kalahari Bushmen, that led to conclusions about who had greater leisure time, a hunter-gatherer or someone involved in a modern agricultural society. Guess who wins that debate? The hunter-gatherer. I mean, it was not, to go back to Pam's point, if you query the elders in any First Peoples group, they will tell you that life has been good. Not that it's been some sort of desperate day-to-day struggle for mere subsistence.
No, because they had the ceremonies. And they didn't, when you see these documentaries of the African pygmies and whomever else running after the giraffe through the bush, and they're totally, with their running ability and all of that stuff, but the elders have stories where you offer your tobacco to an animal and it gives its life to you. Now, it was never described to me that you're going to have a giraffe walk right up to you and say, okay, here I am.
Yeah, it's my time.
But it wasn't as much as a struggle. The same thing that you're seeing.
Well, yeah, and just by example, I saw because it's kind of unavoidable. If Jesus had been around in the current era, that Bible verse would say, "The trolls ye have always with ye." So I saw some post about mountaintop removal on Facebook today, and lo and behold, there they were, the coal trolls. Well, y'all, you tree huggers can just go and freeze to death in the dark. And why don't y'all turn off your electrical computer devices, seeing you don't like the cold?
Right.
And I lost it. I lost it. And I just took two of them by name and peeled the skin off of them. Dumb, stupid little people. We've had coal fired.
Well, I think they have a point because, there's a lot of people who just say, and in Wisconsin we have the mining issue, and they just say no mine. But what they're, you can't ignore if your neighbor who wants a job. We can't do that anymore.
No, but we cannot put that person wanting a so-called job on some sort of a pedestal over people who want to so-called live.
No, but you can't put the environmentalist who doesn't want any economic development on a pedestal either. That's what I'm trying to say.
But the point, Pam, wait, Jay Cruz, the point that I was trying to make is that we have plenty of evidence of successful human life on this planet that did not require, in fact, we've got a hell of a lot more evidence of successful human life on this planet that did not require coal-fired electricity than that which does.
No, it's true, but if you take, a Native American elder, for people who don't know who are listening, they're very far and few between, very far and few between. And as the culture is more and more eroded, they're even farther and further between. An elder in, or an authentic one, is a lawyer, a politician, a traditional healer, a psychologist, an educator. They're everything. They have extrasensory capabilities, and they have specialties as well. They can't do everything, each person, but they have specialties as well, and they're doctors, and they're everything. And what one of those said to me once was that, yes, we know all of this existed, what you're talking about. But you have to take the people from where they're at now and help them make a journey to that other realm of possibilities. But it's like the old adage, you can take a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. Because they have to find their own way in a sort of self-guided, even though you're guiding them type of thing. You know what I mean? So you have to have a consideration for...
Well, there has to be a transition.
Yeah.
There has to be a transition. But here's the thing, though, Pam. We don't have time for a transition. I mean, we could take a walk. Unfortunately, in West Virginia, the horses can't drink the water.
Right.
Now. So,
but I would say people under those circumstances
that time
are not so much prone to saying we need jobs anymore, because they should be understanding at this point how important the water is.
But see, that's the problem, and you know, I don't. I was just today in a seminar all day long about suicide prevention. How, you know, and so one of the things, and you know, we took a break and we talked about, you know, somebody said something about water, and I mentioned about, you know, we were just talking about stuff, you know, in general, and I said about West Virginia, because I don't know, somebody, I don't know how you even got on the topic, and once somebody
said, Tracy, you're breaking up.
West Virginia, you know, I count. Yes, we have a drought, but, you know, at least we have water to drink. And
Tracy, you need to get to a different spot.
Yeah, Tracy.
Can't hear you, Tracy.
No.
You're breaking up, Tracy.
Jay Cruzen, you had something to say a minute ago.
It was still going on in West Virginia. I said no.
I'm sorry, I got to end your call. Not there.
Thank you.
Well, it's that's deeply frustrating when that happens, because the interweb tubes aren't always perfect. Jay Cruzen, you were going to say something a couple minutes ago.
Yeah, I'll say something, and I'm going to depart the conversation for a few minutes. I believe we already have reached a tipping point. I think we're beyond the point of no return, and I do believe there is a good chance we are looking at an extinction level event as far as this climate change goes. And if we don't do anything within the next 10 to 20 years, I'm sure of it. And then beyond that, I'm just going to step out for a few minutes.
Okay.
I'll be back later.
Okay.
May I say something?
Yeah, go ahead, Dave.
Well, I was going to just say remember, I was listening to you talking to Devin. Was it yesterday or the day before at the very end of your show?
Both.
And he was mentioning some stuff about some positive feedbacks. And I talked about a site called Nature Bats Last. I'd recommend people go there to Nature Bats Last. I don't know. All of these issues you've been talking about over the last half hour took place in a period of time where the temperature was at different than it's going to be very soon, and I very soon I'm talking about it. I don't know if it'll be 2 years or 5 years, but I don't believe it'll go on 10 years without changing drastically. That's just from what I've read and what I've learned. I don't know. I'd love to be wrong. I sure hope I am, but it seems like if we survive, we're going to have to find a whole new way of doing things. Live underground like gophers or something. Who knows? But it ain't going to be like it ever was before. No chance of it.
Can I horn in?
My take.
Yeah, jump in, Devin.
Well, I think there will, there is an extinction level event, but not necessarily for humanity. I mean, we're losing species faster than we're finding them or being able to account for them, and
I think
there's also the invasive species you were talking about earlier. I mean, I'm even noticing that here. I don't know, Bob, if you're familiar with them, those brown looking wasps.
Yes.
Yeah, the normal wasps we have around here, they're being replaced by these nasty black and yellow wasps that are extremely hostile. You know, the brown wasps are, docile. You know, you have to really do something to them for them to come after you.
Yeah,
these other things are so mean that you just can't get rid of them.
They're like killer wasps, killer bees or something.
Well,
yeah,
how
I
much
mean,
do you think this extinction, your extinction opinion is affecting how people approach the problem? I mean,
it's not.
Does it mean that they don't look at it long term, and so they only look for short term solutions, or just to be comfortable for the next 10 years?
It's either Band-Aids or ignore it completely.
And we seem to be opting for some pretty busted, broken down Band-Aids.
Yeah,
well, who's we?
These days I would say more ignoring.
Who's we?
But
who is we? We is mostly the entire planet insofar as decisions are decisions are made at a level that are unchallengeable and unaffectable by people who are busy working their butts off every day just to keep the mortgage paid.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's hard to make a change when we don't have a singleness of purpose. So half the people are denying it, it's even going on.
I would go so far as to say that the deniers are not nearly the problem that the ambivalent are, or the just plain don't know, don't care.
You mean the grays?
It's
on the fence.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I don't no, because that implies that there's a decision process going on. They're not making decisions. They're just living in the world they're in, and they'll cope with what comes next until they can't cope anymore.
Bob.
Yeah.
There's one element of the equation that I think people ought to consider as well, and that is what we can do to ourselves to eliminate humanity. Period. Because if you look at the political situation of the world today, who's to say that there isn't going to be some type of worldwide nuclear war? And that's something.
Well, that specter always looms like a shadow over any conversation.
And we have come so close to that on so many occasions. I remember back in '62, and I was a boy. And I can remember back in '83 in Germany with Abel Archer, when they almost pushed the button. Abel Archer was our military adventure as far as reforger in Germany, and that thing nearly came to the boiling point. Then, I mean, that may make all of this null and void.
Well, no, they almost pushed the button in the '90s if. What's his name? Was it Yeltsin? He put the brakes on.
Yeah, they had a problem with that.
I don't know if.
But it was Abel Archer.
I don't know if he was too drunk that day or not drunk enough or. He put the brakes on.
If you want to talk about nuclear disasters, I think that recent history from Chernobyl to Fukushima shows us that we're likely to hurt ourselves far more by accident than by overt acts.
You look at what's happening down in New Mexico with the Los Alamos. They're having radiation leaks down there. I don't know if you all have heard about it.
Oh, yeah, I saw that they had a fire a week or so ago, didn't they?
Yep.
Their water is gone. I talked to a water specialist down there. He said if half the people knew what he knew, they would be totally freaked. Even Santa Fe has radium or whatever in its water now.
And something just to consider, you know, when Pam asked a minute ago, and I replied that people aren't even, you know, they're not even acting, that they're not even that aware of their world around them. And the decisions are being made by the 1%. The story I ran across today about Rex Tillerson, who sounds like a televangelist, but is actually the CEO of ExxonMobil. Now, he's been one of the ones who has pushed hard and fast for frack baby frack. I mean, wherever you are, you need to be fracked. Somebody needs to be fracking wherever we are. Doesn't matter if it's off the coast of California or in Ohio or West Virginia, Pennsylvania, what doesn't matter. Frack. This is an interesting story because it turns out that he's got a $5 million home somewhere down in Texas, Sergi, and a fracking concern wants to build a water tower near his property to provide water to a fracking site that is also nearby. Well,
NIMBY.
What'd you say?
I said NIMBY.
Yeah, well, yeah, Devin, you win the prize for tonight, NIMBY, because Tillerson has joined the plaintiffs in a lawsuit saying, "Don't put that thing near me. It would cause too much noise, and the traffic from hauling the water to the from the tower to the drilling site would be unbearable."
Where the hell is the water going to come from?
But all that water that he's talking about using ought to come from the sewage treatment plant and not from the drinking water. If you think we've hit peak oil, look at California right now. They have hit peak water. So if you want to talk extinction, you better start talking Los Angeles, Phoenix, Arizona, Bullhead City, 29 Palms, Palmdale, all the rest of those places where people want to live in the desert and have green lawns. The capitalist marketplace, as much as I hate capitalism, when water starts costing more than gasoline, those towns will look like Detroit.
No, they won't. They're going to get their water from the Midwest. They're counting on it.
The only problem is the water in the Midwest is going to be ruined by the Keystone XL pipeline. It gets a little complicated, doesn't it?
Well, it's what they call the Windigo complex, right? And the Windigo are the cannibalistic spirits. And they end up eating.
Well, and all those Blackwater releases that we're going to have, too, you know.
I worked on a sewage treatment plant a few years ago, and the operators told me that the water that comes off their plant when the process is all done is pure enough to drink, but by regulation they have to dump it in the creek that flows into the Sacramento River. They can't use it in the drinking water system.
Well, it just means somebody downstream is going to drink it because they're drinking out of the Sacramento River.
Well, yeah. Roger, did you hear they're cutting Redding down 60% from the Sacramento River water?
Yeah, I heard that. And they're also talking about taking the old railroad line that went from Eureka down to San Francisco and putting a water pipe on it and taking water from the Mad River drainage and sending it down the old railroad right away. And because we got plenty of water. We got plenty of water. But everybody else in California is toast. I mean, I've had over a foot of rain in the last 2 weeks.
Where are you at?
I'm just about 130 miles due west of Duncan. I'm right on the coast, about 75 miles south of Oregon.
Okay, that's I know that area. South of Crescent City.
Yeah, I'm just north a little bit north of Eureka.
North of Crescent City.
No, I'm south of Crescent City, north of Eureka.
Okay, I know that area. Yeah, I have a guy that lives in my house. He's from Mendocino County, and he said that one of his friends was just up here a couple of weeks ago, and she was saying that it had been raining pretty hard up there. It was flooding and everything else. So they got a foot of rain. That's good. That's really good.
Yeah, but you still got the problems with the water supply of Willits and Cloverdale and Ukiah and, you know, all the rest of them, because south down there, I mean, you have to get 150 miles north of San Francisco before the drought's even thinking about tapering off. And yet I've got asparagus sprouting up in the garden right now, and it usually doesn't happen until the 15th of March.
A lot warmer.
All the almond trees over here are blooming.
And no bees to pollinate them.
Well, I haven't went out and looked. we got a little ornamental plum tree or something. My dad looked out today and he goes, that thing's blooming. I looked out the window, sure enough.
Yeah, mine bloomed and they've all been knocked off by the rain.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it is going to get pretty dicey. But I still think that people have, I'm not sure what people are more upset about, the extinction of the human race or the extinction of the planet.
I don't
separate the two.
I don't think there's any such thing, at least for a few more billion years until the sun goes nova, as extinction of the planet.
Of the planet. Okay.
Maybe a high percentage of the species.
Yeah.
Maybe a high percentage of the species.
Look, okay. See, even Venus might even come back and have life on it again.
I saw some fascinating computer modeling the other day of what Mars would look like with a with a viable oxygen atmosphere, or what it looked like before it lost its atmosphere.
Mars is that their continental drift or whatever came to an end.
No, please, Pam, go ahead.
No, go ahead. What, finish continental drift?
No, Mars has no tectonic plate movement anymore, so it's done.
The core stopped spinning.
Yeah.
There's no EM field.
But Pam, go ahead. Yeah, I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
No, that's okay. I was just wondering if they thought they were going to create some kind of atmosphere, because they think they can do anything with technology. But then it just reminded me. I don't know what I was looking for, because I was really trying to look at a lot at Fukushima, because I think it's being underreported. And
yeah, there's been another spill, by the way.
Yeah, we'll all agree with you on that one.
It was just this week, right?
Yes.
And there was this really, really weird report on Jeff Wren, so I don't normally follow. It's just I was Googling Fukushima, and this thing came up. And there was some Japanese guy, what's his name, Yoichi Shimatsu, who was former editor of Japan Times, who was talking about how because of the Fukushima fallout, there was particle fallout, and I don't really believe what he was saying, because if I couldn't follow it, I mean, he should have been able to explain it so I wouldn't have 1,000 questions. But he was talking about that there was some particle fallout, and they were trying to control it. So they were creating some kind of electromagnetic field on the west coast that was altering the jet stream, and that's why there was...
Yeah, see, that's a little too rinsy for me.
No, it was a little too rinsy, but I thought it was really interesting just because I don't think it's too far beyond them to try and do things with electromagnetic fields.
But
stuff that they're doing, the chemtrails, that is not...
Terawatts.
No, these people are so hopelessly inept that they can barely tie their own shoelaces. What we're talking about in Fukushima, according to a story dateline February 20th from Reuters, which is a far cry from Jeff Rentz, is that 100 tons of highly contaminated radioactive water has leaked out of a tank.
Mm-hmm.
100 tons. Meanwhile, TEPCO said, well, that's unlikely that it got to the ocean. Masayuki Ono said, we are taking various measures, but we apologize for worrying the public with such a leak. Water is unlikely to have reached the ocean, as there is no drainage in that tank area. Oh, dear God. Again with the tanks, you know? Similar to West Virginia, they discovered it by accident. A worker patrolling the area around 700 meters from the ocean spotted drips of water leaking through a drain attached to the side of the tank. And the water had a reading of 230 million becquerels per liter of beta-emitting radioactive isotopes, including strontium-90.
Strontium-90.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Meanwhile, okay, that was 230 million becquerels per liter. The legal limit for releasing strontium-90 into the ocean is 30 becquerels per liter.
Right, and they were talking about how there is no healthy lower limit, even though they keep saying there is.
In the same family as calcium.
Waggy just put in the chat room. Bob, you really don't want to know what we engineers get taught about tanks and how we learned what little we know from so many, many failures. Yeah,
you know from so many failures?
Yeah.
Yeah, tanks of storage tanks of every kind are difficult to design well, and even the good designs end up failing in spectacular ways due to unforeseen circumstances or other things.
And neglect.
Yeah, okay, so talk about that for a minute, Waggy. The tank farm at Freedom Industries was originally a diesel fuel storage depot for Pennzoil. Mm-hmm. And so they pumped everything out and left and sold it, and Freedom Industries bought it. What kind of principles are involved in determining, it held diesel fuel, it'll certainly hold coal preparation poisons?
Well, first of all, this gunk that they put in it now, that was it a water-based? Was it pure
it was
in a water solution?
No, it was crude. It's an alcohol.
Right. Is it 100%? I thought it was a mixture in a solution.
Water-soluble.
It's
water-soluble, but...
There was another chemical with it, but
the PHP.
It had water.
Mm-hmm.
Or PPH.
Well, the reason I ask is because, you know, diesel is very non-water soluble, so you don't have to worry about it, like, corroding the tanks. This stuff, even if it starts out with no water in it, is going to get water in it and therefore start corroding it. So they should have, and probably didn't, completely remove all the rust from the inside. Yeah, that would have been way expensive to do. And then coat it to prevent, rust that you wouldn't have to worry about with diesel. Just as an off the top of my head, what would you do with something that contained diesel if you're going to recommission it for another chemical that is water hydrophilic, that likes water? That's
Bob,
just for starters.
Bob?
Yeah, Jim.
What was that?
It's also denser, so you'd have to worry a little bit more about pressures.
In other words, it was a great idea.
I mean, these tanks, how long could they last? I mean, everything that you build has a certain life expectancy. It's not going to last forever.
Well, the key there is in maintenance.
Yeah, and it's also a question I'm leading up to with you, Waggy. In light of the fact that in the bankruptcy filing of assets, Freedom Industries estimated that the total value of their entire tank farm, of all every one of those tanks, is $8,000. What does that say about the tank?
Before the disaster,
$8,000.
Yeah, that means that it's got more scrap value. So they're considering it's a bigger liability.
Salvage.
Well, no, it's a sponge now. I mean,
that's why it was asking, was that assessment before the disaster because the liability.
That's after.
Yeah, this is the bankruptcy filing.
Yeah, that's after. And those tanks have been there for, nearly a century? I mean,
they're not that old.
Just the scraps, the scrap steel value is more than $8,000, so they must be subtracting a whole big number from that.
I mean, those tanks are not the pyramids, are they?
No, they are not the pyramids.
Thank you.
Well, they're not, as far as the material, they're not really much steel left. It's more just iron oxide. I mean, they're...
Wouldn't be surprised if there's a little baling wire around, Devin.
Well, with steel or whatever, in the highest form, will eventually begin to oxidize, weaken, and collapse.
Yeah, but rust is still very high purity iron ore and recyclable.
Well, what's fascinating now of this is that it is alleged that it was a one-inch hole that let those 10,000 gallons out into the Elk River.
QED.
Right. So where'd the hole come from? Well, their theory was that the hard freeze caused a pipe to come up and puncture the tank.
Hell, the tank.
Yeah, was it at a seam?
We don't know that.
Yeah, that's the problem. We don't know enough to really get an idea.
It didn't look like it.
Yeah, it wasn't at a seam.
In the picture, it didn't look like it was at a seam, but if you looked at the structure of the material, I think it was probably corrosion. I mean, it, like I said, literally a sponge.
And this stuff is a corrosive, is it not? Well, I tell you what, everybody, it has been an absolutely delightful Friday on the front porch. We're going to have to wrap it up.
Thank you,
Pam. Thank you, Dave. Thank you, Kevin. Thank you, Jim, one and all. Thank you to the Skype Horn Malloy chat group, Jeremy, Jay Cruzen, Waggy, Devin, Larry, Roger, Sparky, and Sergi. Thank you, one and all. And so we'll be heading out of here. Sparky, the group's going to continue on post 9 o'clock, correct?
Correct, because
9 o'clock Eastern time.
Malloy is encore tonight.
Right. So, anybody want to jump in? Just contact Sparky, Sparky Dunk on Skype, and jump on in. And the conversation is obviously fine. So, thanks one and all. We will begin the program come Monday with a fundraising goal of $275, because we have pulled up this week $125 short. But, you know, we'll get there. We'll figure out a way. Thanks, everybody, for all you do to make this conversation possible. It is your participation in oh so many ways that makes this something that people want to spend their time with, and that is much more about you than it is about me. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff. Obviously, Sparky, the longtime moderator of the Horn Malloy Skype chat group, also a moderator along with Lottie and Texas Betsy in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you, John Fox. Thank you, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Tomorrow is the anniversary of the execution of Sophie Scholl and her brother and the other members of the White Rose, the original White Rose Society. And it is an anniversary worth noting, and we do so here. Thank you to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and acheact.org, acheact.org. If you would like to be active, if you want to do something that makes a difference in Appalachia, then I strongly suggest you go to acheact.org and get busy telling people about this critical bill that is the best chance Appalachia has for any future at all. And always, always, always. Gina, it's all for you. Y'all have a great weekend. Rick Smith is next on the Horn.